There is a kind of a tale that once upon a time I read. I think I was supposed to be kind of a Buddhist tale, I don't know. It goes something like this, that these children are at the beach and they're playing with the sand, building sandcastles, destroying each other's sandcastles, and building new ones and jumping up and down on top of each other's, and there's all this drama and play and excitement of the day at the beach. And it's finally they build a series of big sandcastles, each claiming their own castle. But then it's time to go home. And they run off home, and the tide comes in and washes away everything they built. So humans, like those of us here, can build our sandcastles. And then with our sandcastles we build, we fight and play and love and do the human thing. But they're just sandcastles. The tide will come and they wash them away. So that's basically the story. But as I think of that story, I think of all the times I've sat on the beach, maybe up on a little dune looking out, and just happily watched the tide come and go, the waves wash up along the beach, then wash out, and you see the water kind of get absorbed into the sand a little bit, and some of it washes out and just comes back, and all the different patterns. And I've done that here in the Pacific many times, looking out across the Pacific at the horizon and the blue sky, and and I've wondered, how long has that Pacific Ocean, what we call the Pacific Ocean, been sending waves across the ocean to wash across the shores? It probably did it across the shores before there was the North American continent. There are other continents before that, but this is, this kind of particular longitude and latitude, perhaps. Where I'm sitting watching the beach, these waves have been coming and going, and or just floating across vast bodies of water. I've been sailing out in the middle of oceans and see no land. And how long has the scenery like this been going on this planet of ours? Billions of years, maybe a billion. Not quite sure, it all changed so much when we started getting an atmosphere. And then we started getting clouds and other things. But the length of time of this natural unfolding that we have of the waves, of the oceans, of the continents, of the appearance of life on land coming out of the water, and they consider, that maybe happened about a billion years ago or so, I think. I'm not sure exactly where, but. And then one of the oldest pieces of life that still stands, kind of like it was a long time ago, is what we have here on this property, these redwood trees. Redwood trees have existed for somewhere between 100 and 200 million years. They're considered some of the oldest and largest kind of species that's continuously lived on this planet with us or before us. We're lucky enough to have been invited in by them. And it's phenomenal. The tide comes and goes, the waves come and go, and humans build kingdoms, queendoms, and destroy them. I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was 12, 13 years old, and to study ancient civilizations that no longer existed. I studied and learned a bit about how there were the great civilizations 4,000 years ago, and 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, and I lived in places where I saw the devastation of what humans can do to where they destroy their own civilizations. Often by destroying the natural part of the world that's sustaining them, supporting them. The Romans logged the forests and some of the islands near where I grew up, off the coast of Italy. And so then it was all eroded away. The Greek islands as well are so beautiful in their starkness. They weren't always stark. Someone overgrazed, overfarmed, overlogged. To build cities and civilizations that then the tide comes in, the tide comes out. Some years ago, as many of you know, I went down the Grand Canyon. It starts right underneath the Hoover Dam. And that's about 60 years old, 50, 60 years old or something like that. Not so old. And the back of the dam, the dam is already, the inside, the lake that's there, the reservoir, is already filling up with silt. I don't think they anticipated it. And it's not going to last much longer, this dam, this huge thing that they built. The equivalent of the tides coming in and coming out, the amount of time that that dam's going to last in the history of that canyon is a snap of the finger. You know, it's just like barely, the river, it's just like always winds in the canyon. It just comes over. And so there's had this, we build these, humans build all this stuff. And it comes and it goes. The tides come, the tides go. And then we fight over what we build. We build moats and walls around our constructions that we have, holding people away in all kinds of ways. And the tides come and the tides go. And I talk about this, these constructions, because among the distinctions that the Buddha made, not too explicitly, but talked about these things, he talks about the constructions that humans make. And for him, it's the mental constructions, primarily. And the way the mental constructions then also constructs parts of our body, shapes our body in certain ways. And these constructions and the word construction in English, I don't think we too frequently use it for, like, do bees, again, maybe, do we say bees construct their hive? But the word that's being translated as constructions here is sankharas. And sankharas were limited in the time of the Buddha to be what humans build, what they prepare, what they make that does not exist by itself in the natural world, but something that is born and arises out of the human mind, its thoughts and its ideas. And it can be quite wonderful what it builds, but it's sandcastles too. It comes and it goes, the tides come and the tides go. And for the Buddha to call these things constructions, he calls sankharas, they're things that are prepared, they're made up, born of the mind. And if it wasn't for the human mind, if you looked around before humans appeared, looked up and down under the redwood trees, on top of them, in the oak groves, down by the ocean, by the shore, you would find nothing that was a product of human constructions, the human mind and its intelligence and its creativity and its what it can do. And now you can't go very far in this world without seeing something the product of what human beings have constructed and made. And the amount of plastic on the ocean, you know, it's phenomenal. Some, you know, we have a relatively clean beach here, but some places in the world, the beaches are packed full of debris, of plastic mostly, trash. All originating in the minds that's making up new things, designing new things, implementing them and constructing these things that are synthetic. We might call them artificial. So the Buddha didn't know what all this that we know today, but he did know that there are things that don't exist in the natural world, you can't go out and see them, that belong to the constructive activity of the mind, the engineering, the building, putting things together. That I think he would say, he doesn't use this language, but we can probably, for the purposes of just general conversation here, to say that these are not natural things that are coming into the mind. These constructs that can be made up, they're synthetic. They're artificial in a certain way. And these are problematic. And another word, way of translating sankharas, is reactivities. And the way the Buddha talks about it, the constructions we have become reactivity that in their reaction makes more constructions. It's kind of a loop. They kind of build each other. So you kind of see with reactivity is we have a reaction, and sometimes we're reacting to our reactivity. Reactivity is coming out of our reactivity. It goes on and on and on. People wonder why they have these habits that are always going on and on and on. And you might protest, say, Gil, it's all natural. Even the thoughts and the dreams and the constructions and we have, it's all natural. But there is a distinction the Buddha makes between that which happens through the constructing thought constructions of the mind that you can't see in the natural world. And those activities that happen in the organic qualities of the human being that are part of the natural world, they're not part of that constructive, thoughtful, made-up mind that makes things up. A baby who is born, and its first breath, that's not a learned activity. It didn't plan that out, engineer it all out, and like reason it out. You know, I think taking a breath would be a good idea. I wonder what volume of oxygen I should take in just to get it right. And how much work should I do to, you know, the diaphragm? And, you know, it's kind of built into the natural system of the human being, the biological system. That when we're born, generally people start breathing. Sometimes they need a little help, apparently. And so we grow up, and all this kind of a natural force. I used to joke with my kid that I would put my hand on top of his head and say, stop growing. That's enough. And he thought it was the funniest thing that I was trying to stop him from growing. Like, it can't be done, right? As long as we keep feeding them. It's just a natural thing that there's a developmental process. It's going to happen no matter what. And there's these natural developmental processes that we're all part of. And some of us at some point or other, it dawns on us, you know, I think maybe soon I'm going to start aging. So, you know, stop aging. And so there are these kind of what we can call lightly natural processes, biological processes operating. So this distinction is actually very important in engaging in this meditation practice we're doing. because what Buddhist meditation is trying to do is to free us of our reactivity around all these constructions that the mind makes. The primary of them is constructions around self, me, myself, and mine. And it's the I sphere, the self sphere, just like there's the atmosphere and all these logos. Some people call it the logosphere and all these things. There's a sphere of self-making that we live in. Now, if you kind of look around the room to search for yourself out there in the room, where is it? It's not there. But then your eyes might land on the place you're sitting. And of course, the cushion you're sitting on or the chair you're sitting on is not yourself, not me, but it is mine for this moment. And that would probably be really clear if you had to suddenly go off to the bathroom during the middle of the talk and you were eager to come back and not miss anything, and you came back and someone was sitting in your seat. Then I think, oh my, they took my seat, how could they? And now I have to find another seat and there's none in here, and it becomes a drama. The sandcastle of my seat has been created. It does not exist in the natural world. It's a construct of the mind. It's an idea the mind has formed. And it's connected to a lot of other constructs. The Dharma talk, what I'm going to get from it, what I'm trying to get, you know, I want something here and I can't get it now because someone's had my seat and where am I going to sit? And, you know, it goes on, these constructs. And then the mind starts making up stories and thoughts and plans and wishes and are all about this. And so then pretty soon you're thinking about, well, next time I'm come, I'm going to make sure to come to IRC with a bicycle chain and a lock to put over my chair and so that no one takes it or no one sits in it. And then I wonder what kind of chain I should get. What's a good chain for a retreat center? It probably doesn't have to be that strong. Because I don't think anybody comes here with chain cutters, so I probably can save some. And so the mind spins out and does all this stuff. It's all this constructive world. Have some of you been living in your constructions today? A little bit? Once. Yeah, it happens accidentally, occasionally. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the constructs of the mind, the storytelling of the mind, the reactivity of the mind to things, is intimately connected to constructs of self, who we think we should be, who we want to be, what we want for ourselves, what we don't want for ourselves. And to what degree, some of that is maybe a natural part of our biological system. We want to be safe. We want to be fed. We want to have pleasure or something. But it gets integrated or connected to what is synthetic, what is artificial, which is has a lot, as I said before, has a lot to do with this concept of self, me, myself, and mine. We take things as me. This is who I really am. And you know, some people, as the kind of slogan goes, some people are more concerned about their hair or the clothes they wear than the words they speak, because that defines who they are. Their clothes, their hair, their makeup, their car, all kinds of things. And so much that we do, what we do is for human beings is often connected to building up a sense of self, creating a self in relationship to other people, becoming attractive, becoming safe, attaining status, all kinds of things that go on. And so then the natural desire to want to be safe, it gets confused or gets integrated with certain kind of unnecessary and in some sense unnatural, constructs around self. And then we fight over the sandcastles. So when we the reason I'm talking about this here at this beginning of the retreat, a lot of the legacy, the heritage we receive from our daily life at Common Retreat has to do with the momentum of the reactivity that's been built up. We have a construct, we have some idea that what should be, some idea of self, for example, and reality encounters reality. And so if, you know, if my identity as a Dharma teacher really depends on having the right color blue sweater, and that's what I see my whole status as a Dharma teacher is all about, the blueness of the sweater. But my blue sweater disappears and I have to wear a white one. And so now the presence of white rather than blue becomes a problem, and it runs into something, that construct, this idea of how I should be, and now fear and shame and dread and anger and dismay and discouragement, depression. There's no shortage of what happens when reality hits that concept, challenges it this way. And so then from that comes more reactivity and more reactivity and more attempts to prove or hide or run or make stories and all that. And the mind spins out. So the constructs are something we have to be very careful with. They have their role, they have their place. But the mental constructs that we live in, that we create, are kind of artificial in that they're only a product of human construct. They don't exist in the natural biological world. Human beings have some really marvelous qualities, characteristics, that I would say is part of the natural biological system, that we're not engineering, we're not constructing and making, that we're supported by. Most of our biology is so complex, we could never engineer it, we could never build it up. So as I often like to say, you know, I could accidentally cut my finger, chop with you know, in the kitchen, and I can't engineer the healing of it. It's a complicated physiological event, the healing of a cut, keeping it from being infected, but I can support it, I can keep it clean, I can support that natural functioning working well, but I can't make it happen. So that's true with a cut. Is it true with heartbreak? Does the heart, does something inside of our system have a natural capacity for healing heartbreak? Is it true for depression? You know, this is one of the big issues in this country. Depression is huge. And I don't know what, some of it's biological, physiological, in its roots, and it needs to be addressed that way. But I've read, you know, a number of places where psychologists want to claim that a great part of depression comes from rumination, the self-talk that people tell themselves. And we get stuck in loops of self-talk, which is debilitating, discouraging, dismaying. And if the same self-talk gets repeated 10,000 times, just one time it doesn't do much, but after 10, it just slowly wears people down and discourages them, and people feel like they want to give up. But is there any kind of natural process of healing that? I don't want to be too promise much of anything around depression, but just like with healing in the cut, if we can keep dirt out of it and keep it clean, something happens, something heals. With these constructs of the mind and reactivity of the mind, if we could stop feeding it, stop putting more dirt in it, stop continuing the process of recreation of the constructs and reactivity, things begin to relax, things begin to soften, things begin to easing up. The tension that's held in many of these constructs, the tension that's held in reactivity, begins to settle and relax. And that's a natural process of letting go. Natural process of relaxing. In order to stay tense, the mind has to work at it. Tension is a product of the constructive, reactive activity of the mind, generally. And meditation practice is meant to help to settle and quiet the reactive mind, to quiet this constructive activity of the mind so something else can begin to happen. And what is that something else? I know what it's not. It's not having more constructions. It's not reacting anymore. It's not building up more of what can be fit into this that we can call the artificial nature of this world, the synthetic stuff that the mind creates. I don't know, I didn't look at it much at all this last weekend, but I couldn't help but to see some of the photographs of the coronation of the King of England. Wow, is that an artificial event? Wow, is that a product of constructive minds and reactivity? And I mean, that's pure. That's completely. There's natural clothes that are made from cotton and synthetic clothes made from plastics that don't decay. Maybe, well, that belonged to the synthetic world. That whole pageantry and that. Oh, it was kind of amazing to see. So that was like the extreme version of something. And it didn't seem like a lot of the people there were happy. I saw some of the pictures, and it did not look like a happy event for the most part. But who knows? How do I know how to read happiness in other people's hearts? Maybe they were just delighted. And amused, and saw it all as provisional, and nothing to get attached to. Kingdoms come, kingdoms go. So the reason I'm saying this is that many of us will try to fix the reactive, constructive parts of the mind with more constructions, with more reactivity. If only I try, let me come to meditation, well, tell me the technique and I'll just have to kind of put A and B and C together and do this and organize this. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, meditation by the numbers, like painting by the numbers. Just do all these things and get everything in place and then boom. And the most common way that this operates for a lot of people, especially people who are newer to meditation, is thinking, if only I get my mind concentrated, everything will go fine. That's the key. And then work at this concentration like it's a task. Like it's just, you have to just do the right things with the mind, you know, and focus. And the more you strain, the better you'll concentrate probably, right? Because the point is to be concentrated. So it doesn't matter if you strain, because that's just the way to get concentrated. Something like that. And I think a lot of meditators learn that it doesn't work to work at concentrating. It is possible to get concentrated, but generally it doesn't come from this synthetic, reactive work mode. In fact, sometimes people get concentrated by accident. How did that happen? I've been trying for days to get concentrated, and then I just sat down after a nice nap, and like, what happened suddenly? I didn't do that, but now I'm settled and peaceful and quiet. there's a way of getting concentrated which is less about doing and more about allowing, more about getting out of the way. The first instruction I got in meditation when I went to Thailand, the very first thing I ever heard, I was like been there maybe, I don't know, a few hours only. I went to stay at a monastery. And a Western monk was talking to and said, oh, concentration. I think he was into mindfulness. And he was a little bit dismissive of concentration, but he said, oh, concentration, it's just about letting go. That's all you have to do is let go. And that made a big impression on me. Just let go, let go. And it's, I think it's true to some degree. There's a way in which not doing and letting go into the present moment is more concentrating for most people than straining and pushing and trying. So this idea of constructing and trying to make our practice versus making room for something that's closer to a natural biological process to operate is part of what helps this process. So rather than bringing the self, the construct of self, to be the agent to construct more stuff, what we're doing is deconstructing the self, putting to rest all the machinations of the synthetic world that the mind is able to make, and rely on something else. And we are relying on something, just like when you're letting the cut in your hand heal, you're relying on something else. In meditation, we're also relying on a healing power that exists within our biological, organic system we have. And what is that? It's maybe many things. I hope that all of you have had maybe some little hints of something that kind of arose inside of you that you weren't planning. Maybe you were at the beach and you felt a sense of awe or wonder. Wow. Can you construct the awe and the wonder? Just, you know, get a recipe and put them all in place and line them all up and boom, wow. What about love, the love you might have for a small child. The way that parents and grandparents and friends relate to a brand new born baby. I mean, it's kind of like, sometimes it's a little bit too much. Constructive world, the reactive world, but sometimes it's just like the softness and delight and appreciation and kind of the heart gets so soft and warm and nice. Is that a natural process? No, Gil. It's just a lot of oxytocin gets released. Oxytocin is a natural process. It's not part of this constructive part of the mind. We don't want to, just because we can find physiological reasons for why we get triggered and have these feelings come up, doesn't mean that it's not natural. What we're relying on in meditation, or what we can come to rely on, are natural processes to feel contentment, to feel calm, to feel joy, to feel love, to feel safe, to feel unified, to feel, to have a clarity of vision, to see clearly. And so part of meditation is to relax enough to allow something else to be born. And the Buddha uses the language to be born for what I'm calling natural processes. And he uses language of construction for that which is not so natural. And he actually talks about to abandon and destroy the constructions. And the most dramatic example of this in the suttas is there's a poem that's attributed to the Buddha, it's Enlightenment, where he says, "House builder, you have been seen. Your rafters have been broken and destroyed, never to be rebuilt again," something like that. And the rafters, the house here is a constructed piece of human effort. It doesn't exist in the natural world by itself. The another image that's used in Tibetan tankas, these drawings, Tibetan drawings of the 12-fold dependent arising. The sankharas, what I'm calling reactivity or constructs, is a potter who makes a pot, a clay pot. So again, clay pots don't exist in the natural world. Again, they're products of the human world, human life. And there's an image that's provided of a liberating insight, a liberated mind, standing on the edge of a clear mountain lake, looking into the clear water, and seeing in the bottom of the water broken pottery shards. So this, the house is broken, the pots are broken. But what doesn't get broken are these beautiful things that get born from within. Joy is born from within. There's a meditative joy that the Buddha uses the word born. Happiness is born. There's other things that are just born. This natural process, they unfold. And one of my favorite examples of this natural process is the Buddha talks about how a chicken hen sits on her eggs to incubate the eggs. And as long as she sits there and keeps them nice and warm, even if she has a thought that she doesn't want them to hatch, they will hatch. And likewise, people who do the practice Dharma and have all the Dharma practice going nicely for themselves, even if they have the thought they don't want to be enlightened, they will. Isn't that quite something, the statement? You can't stop enlightenment. An example of what you have to have in place is the Eightfold Path. But you're not constructing enlightenment, you're incubating it. And that's what we're doing here in this retreat. We're incubating something. And would you approach the retreat practice differently if you were told you had to build and create and make yourself into something, versus you said, come, and let's incubate something. Let's let something germinate and grow in the soil and sprout and develop. Maybe you have eggs that don't want to hatch. What are your chickens? And maybe there is a shell around you. Sometimes in psychology we talk about people have armor around them. They live in a hard shell. And maybe that's part of that incubating and letting something from the inside grow and develop. Confidence can grow and develop. We can grow in calmness and peace. And we can grow in non-reactivity. We can grow in discernment. And one of the pieces of discernment is to see things more clearly so we can make contrast. We can see distinctions. And one of the important distinctions is to be able to see, oh, that's a construct. That's a reactivity. First, no, this is a wholesome unfolding and movement within me. This is a healthy thing. And to begin recognizing the small hints of wholesome states, the small hints of calmness, of equanimity, of wisdom, of discernment, of confidence, of joy, of happiness. And to not build more of it, but to make room for it to grow and develop. To understand what can nourish it. And the language the Buddha uses is nourishment. We provide nourishment for these eggs inside, nourishment for things to grow and develop within us. We nourish them. We don't bring a hammer and nails and electric drills and screws to put it ourselves together. We're not a construction process project. We're a natural process that can be supported and helped. And it's phenomenal how much we interfere with that as human beings. Just amazing. And I think a lot of human suffering comes from how we interfere with the natural process that's here. A lot of the stress, a lot of the, some of the illnesses we have come from that. I read a story, I was reading some kind of article about anger. And there was some story of a doctor from the 1700s, I think, who had a lot of anger. And apparently he said at some point, the next person who makes me angry is going to give me a heart attack, or I'm going to have a heart attack. And then not that much later, he did. He probably felt the stress and the cost of anger on his system. And so this is a long way of coming to the point I want to make. That's often said directly from the beginning of first day retreat. What supports this whole process a lot is to have faith, to trust that there is this kind of something here that wants to support you. We often call it the refuges, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. It's the practice, it's mindfulness. There is this kind of dharmic process or natural process that's waiting to be happened if we can support it. So when I said this morning for the instructions, to know, to feel, and to relax, that comes directly out of the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha there, he says, know the breathing, feel the body, and relax the bodily constructs. Relax the bodily reactivity. Relax that part of the tensions of your body that come from the reactivity. And this process of knowing and feeling is the beginning of this process of allowing something to show itself, to know something valuable. And one of the valuable things to know is that we're tense. It's okay, you're allowed to relax. That was a revelation when I read the suttas, because when I did Zen practice, no one ever told me to relax. I was told, you know, just sit there, don't do anything but sit there. But to realize you can relax, and then not only is relaxing good, but it helps the incubation. It creates better conditions for something. And the locale, in the best I can recover it from the Buddha's teachings, the place where the incubation happens is in the lower torso. If anything needs to be tended and cared for and loved and relaxed and kind of made room to kind of open, it's the lower torso. Very different from the upsurging energy that goes into the head when we're involved in the constructive world, the synthetic world, this reactive world. So to relax and come down and settle here, to know, to feel from the inside out, to relax deeply, to give a lot of time for this to happen. If it's all about incubating something, you can't just sit on it for 10 seconds and then go have tea. come back and sit on it and have a snack. Go sit on it, and then I'll do metta and sit on it for 10 seconds. And you know, I'll do concentration on breathing now and come back. Now, I think open awareness. You have to stay intimate. You have to stay close to feel and sense and feel connected here. And you have to give it a lot of time. And that's what I said earlier. We have to give yourself a lot of time here to allow something to unfold, something to unfold that's not of your doing. But be able to see the distinction between what is wholesome and what is not. See what belongs to the world of reactivity and what does not. What is beneficial and what is not. And incubate what is beneficial. Incubate what is good for you. And even if what you're incubating is non-reactive attention, even what you're incubating is just some kindness to your attention, then what you're incubating is more kindness. What you're incubating is more non-reactivity. And that grows and develops and becomes valuable. But if we don't see the incubation process as important, if we don't see the wholesome as important, if we don't give lots of time for this process, because we have all kinds of constructs to get involved in, plans and memories and, you know, then we limit how much we incubate. And some of you might have very good reasons to go up into your thoughts, remember the past, plan the future, figure out what happened in those events and the, you know, conversations you had, and review everything. There might be good reasons for it. I'm not trying to belittle it. But I'd like to suggest that here at this retreat, you have something much better to do. Incubate. Sit on those eggs so they have a chance to grow and break out of their shells and come alive in a wonderful way for you. There is something waiting to be born in you. We don't quite know what it is yet. But to sit here with that as an orientation, this natural part of the biological, this inner, this upwelling from within, not the needs and the demands of the control tower up in the head. The control tower itself can be healed. It too has a place in this natural order, but it needs a whole different orientation than how many of us have spent a lifetime with it. And so in the Anapanasati Sutta, the second tetrad, it says, ends with relax the mental constructs, relax the mental reactivity. And what gets born then? What has a chance to surface then, when everything is kind of settled and quiet? So I hope that this talk has highlighted for you a distinction that you're able to make, maybe in a rudimentary way at first, between the constructed world, the reactive world of thoughts and ideas and stories and identities that we create and build for ourselves, that can seem more real than anything else, but involve tension, energy in the mind churning away. To see that versus something that is more biological, natural, more deeper, more innate, something that exists because it arises from within. It's born from within, not constructed, not made up. And what is that? I hope you don't try to think out the answer, but I hope that you make room for the answer to appear for you by sitting quietly and peacefully and just being a good chicken. So, thank you.